Women in computing is not a topic that I talk about very often. In fact, the last time I talked about it was about 2005. I participated in a series of panels, and this was just around the time that people were starting to get an idea that we might have a problem with low numbers of women graduating from computer science, low numbers of women participating in open source. And so part of the reason I haven't participated much in at least public speaking around the topic since then is I found it a very unpleasant experience. Pretty much every panel that we did over and over again ended in a stream of women coming up to the microphone and ranting, venting, anger at their bad experiences. And that was pretty overwhelming for me. I found it very, very unpleasant. I've watched the conversation since then, and I've seen as it has shifted. And I've been quite happy to see that it has shifted from, you know, sort of the stages of grief. Anger is often the first stage of grief. And then over time, you shift, and you begin to accept the problems and begin to have strategies around solutions. And I've been extremely happy to see that happening. But another part of the reason that I haven't spoken about the topic much is I didn't feel like I had much that I could say. It was hard for me to see women talking about their bad experiences because I have had a universally good experience, completely and totally. I have never, ever been disrespected. I have never dealt with discrimination in my job. I have never dealt with harassment. I have never dealt with any of the things that these women were talking about. And it was hard to stand up there in front of them and be an example of here's how you can get through all of these hard things when I hadn't encountered any of those hard things. So I took a step back and I'm like, let's just let this happen. Let it go where it can be. I'm not going to lead in any way in this change. But recently, you know, in the past year, I've been mentoring a young woman, or at least younger than me, and I found that even though my experience is very different than many people, the lessons that I've learned are incredibly valuable. And that while some of it is just pure luck, you know, I happen to work at really good places and with really good people, some of it is also the way I think about the world. And, you know, talking with this younger woman, I realized that in some ways the way I view the world has affected the way that I interact with people, and that has affected the outcome of my work. And lastly, a piece that I really didn't give myself enough credit for is I tend to be a little bit of a chess player. I tend to think ahead. And if I think through my history, there are moments in time when I managed to, I won't say forestall, but actually avoid things that would have been problematic down the road. It's like I was thinking enough ahead that I solved the problem before it happened. And at the time, I just kind of figured, oh, no problem, no big deal. But looking back, I can see how some things would have been a big mess if I had left them running long enough. So I think maybe I do have some perspectives that can be helpful for other people. And I'll share some of them today. My view of the world is very much that there are many truths, and they can be all true simultaneously with some percentage of probability around the truth. So there is a very, very good chance that my perspectives will not help you, or you may even disagree with them, and I am totally okay with that. If you disagree with everything I say, then I am thrilled that you have thought through the issues and have a strong opinion on it. And ultimately, I think that every one of us has a personal path that we end up taking, that we end up navigating through our life. And I wish that I had the time to sit and talk with each one of you, because I think that each one of you has a different story to tell. And I think that you know, in many ways, listening to each other, like really listening to each other and encouraging each other, is one of the most powerful things that we can do. Maybe I will get a chance to talk to most of you this week. We'll see. So I'm going to start with a little bit of history, because I think that my background, in some ways, offers some perspective on where I've ended up in life. So going back to the very, very, very beginning, I come from a very large family. So I have a couple of sisters and four brothers. All of my brothers are younger than me, and I have found, curiously, that as I enter into work situations or life situations, I tend to view all men as my brothers. Not just as my brothers, but as my younger brothers. And I can't say for sure, but I have a suspicion that I have subconsciously related to them in such a way that I'm just like a tiny bit superior to them, but at the same time, very sympathetic to them. And that somehow that unconscious way of relating has had an effect on the way they relate back to me, because I have pretty much universally been respected by men. I've never had that issue, and I don't know. It could be, again, complete coincidence, could have absolutely nothing to do with anything, but I've wondered sometimes if that might have had an impact. And just, you know, the fact that I felt really, really comfortable in a big group of rowdy guys might have made me easy, you know, easygoing and comfortable in places that could be uncomfortable for other people. That's very possible. So my mother was a hippie flower child and a ballet dancer and a ham radio operator. And one of the things that she taught me my entire life is that I could be absolutely anything I wanted to be. Anything at all. She was also a full-time mother. That was her choice. That was what she wanted to be. That was what she wanted to do. When the kids grew up, she went back and got a degree in psychology and worked as a counselor, like a family therapist. But that was her choice, and I respect that as well. My dad was a programmer. Well, in the 60s, he was the guitarist for a Beatles hair band called the Heinous Mushroom Creatures. But later in life, he was a programmer and a computer science professor. And he's the one who taught me programming. And because of that, computing was for me, from the very beginning, a very social experience. You know, in a big family, you don't get a lot of one-on-one time with your parents. My parents were very involved, but, you know, it tends to be like big groups. Whereas I was the only kid out of all the boys and all the girls who was interested in computing. I mean, they're all more advanced in computing than the average human, but I was the only one who was really interested in programming. So that was like my time with my dad. Was working on building games and writing software. And that kind of has stuck with me. I know I've heard some women say, well, I don't want to get into computing. It just involves like sitting in front of a computer all day by yourself, which is, that totally baffles me when I hear it, because like for me, computing is fundamentally a social activity. My family moved around a lot. I never lived in one place more than about 3 years, and what that left me with is very comfortable dropping into new situations and figuring out new things, and that has served me very well over and over again. As I drop into work situations and I have to like learn a completely new programming language and learn a new operating system, and it's just sort of a mindset of being prepared for change. It's sort of a comfort level with unfamiliar things. One of the places that my family spent a great deal of time in was Eastern Africa. And that gave me a somewhat unusual perspective on gender, because I saw very strictly defined gender roles all around me all the time. And I sat in with my parents on their anthropology classes, so I learned at a very early age why cultures create gender roles, how the gender roles function, but I also had a kind of an external view of it, because for me, gender roles were something you study in anthropology class. They were something that you observe in other cultures. They weren't my culture. They didn't apply to me, and that's what I learned at a very, very young age was, oh, look at those interesting gender roles. I can see how those function. But it never even occurred to me that I might be affected by gender roles. It was just, we spent too much time outside of American culture for me to even notice that there were gender roles in American culture. And that gave me a kind of freedom that I don't often see. And that was, you know, it stuck with me my entire life. I do see that there are gender roles that exist, but I cannot conceive of applying them to myself. They just don't make any sense. And it's not like a stressful thing. It's just, okay, whatever. I sometimes wish I could like inject that into people around me so that they could feel that sort of sense of freedom, because it really is a gift. So a little bit older. I mentioned my father was a computer science professor, and we traveled around Africa. So in high school, he took me through what was essentially a graduate program in computer science, which is fantastic. But when I got to college, I thought, I don't want to do computer science again. That would be really, really boring. and boredom is something I struggle with. They tell me I have a high IQ, but I don't really think IQ is a measure of anything useful. But I do have a very creative brain, and I remember things very well. I never watch movies twice or read books twice, because I remember the entire story in intricate detail, and I just can't stand to sit through it a second time. So I didn't study computer science in college. I studied linguistics, which is kind of related. It's human languages instead of computer languages. But I suppose in undergraduate as well as my later graduate studies, the way I've always taken it is sort of curiosity, following your curiosity. So I studied linguistics in undergraduate. I've studied, mathematics, quantum physics, astrophysics, like 25 different languages. I think the important thing is to follow your imagination, because every one of these completely irrelevant topics has ended up feeding back into computing, oddly enough. It's unfortunate that the current computer science curriculum often drives women away because it is so divorced from anything real, unfortunately. It's very theoretical. And I admire physics. You know what I admire most about physics? You open a physics textbook, and the first thing it says is, there was a time when we thought the Earth was flat, and we were wrong. And then there was a time when we thought that the sun rotated around the Earth, and we were wrong. And then there was a time, and it goes through all these things, like, we were wrong, we were wrong, we were wrong. And it's like, that's the most important thing for you to learn first is, hey, you know, we're not infallible. We learn things and we keep improving. Computer science hasn't reached that point yet. It's a very immature science. And so it thinks that it knows everything. It thinks that it has everything right, that static evaluation is perfect and is the gold standard of the future, despite the fact that static evaluation doesn't really deal with concurrency very well. And all of computing is rapidly running towards concurrency. So, you know, in 50 years, I hope we'll look back and computer science, the first thing we'll see in a computer science textbook is, once upon a time, we thought such and such, and we were wrong. And then once upon a time, we thought this, and we were wrong. And they'll be much more open-minded. But in the meantime, you may find that you don't actually want a degree in computer science. You may find that you'd rather have a degree in medicine and a minor in computer science, or education and a minor in computer science, or physics and a minor in computer science, or math, or whatever. And that's okay. Like, don't feel constrained that the box that people have put computing in today is the box that you have to live in. So in some ways, I did family entirely backwards. I got married when I was barely over 20. I had a kid in my early 20s, mid-20s, and I can't say I recommend it. You know, it didn't last. I was way too young to be married. I had no clue what I was getting into. But it had an interesting side effect, which is at the point in my career when many women are, you know, like their career is taking off and they're thinking, oh, do I want to take time off and have kids? Do I want to get married? You know, all these things. And for me, it wasn't even a question. I had already been married. I already had a kid. He was old enough. He was pretty independent. You know, it wasn't, like, it ended up working out well, but I don't recommend it. My career is another one of the things that, I mean, I think, I would say sound advice is plan your career in advance, but I didn't. I didn't at all. If anything, my career found me. You know, I was working as a research linguist in East Africa, and I had a fractured vertebra. I had a bad back. I couldn't travel around and do research linguistics anymore. Riding around in those bad roads in the rickety old cars was just not something I could do. So disaster, right? But in fact, it ended up working well for me anyway. And this is something that I've observed over and over and over again in my life, that every time something bad happens, something really bad, it ends up growing into something good. And I call it one of the fundamental laws, like the conservation of energy. It's like a conservation of happiness. So I had to make a change, right? I couldn't do my current job anymore. So I thought about my options. And I thought about what I loved most about my job. And one of them was travel. And I thought, okay, I have to give up travel. I can't do that anymore. Wasn't entirely true, but at the time, that's what I thought. But the other thing was the computing aspect. So as a research linguist, we did a lot of work like parsing language data and, you know, doing statistic analysis on language data. And that was one of the things that I loved the most about my job. So I thought, okay, considering that my alternative is essentially a desk job as a linguistics professor forever, like never going out into the field, never traveling, just, you know, your one little sort of your rotation on the wheel over and over again for the rest of my life, which did not appeal to me at all. I thought I'd try. Let's see about this computing stuff. You know, I've been a programmer since I was 8. You know, I don't have a degree in the subject, but I do know a lot about it. I've studied a lot about it. So let's see. So my first programming job was as a software tester at my dad's company. I did that for about a year, and I had a blast. It was a lot of fun. And I kind of had this feeling of, it's like, okay, I've been breathing all these years. I didn't realize people would pay me to breathe. My next job was as a web designer for an online bookseller, and when I took that job, I mentioned to them, you know, I'm interested in being a programmer. I just, you know, I think this is a good entry point. I had an art background. I had been, you know, a painter, and I had done a little bit of my own web development as well, like my own personal website. So about 3 months into this job, and now looking back, I'm like, 3 months? Really? 3 months? I went to my manager and I said, so, you know, I've been working at this design job, and you know, I mentioned when I started that I was interested in programming. So I was just wondering if we could kind of like maybe work out a timeline for when I might move into programming, you know, what kind of steps I might take between now and then. And I have no idea what happened, absolutely none. But 3 days later, I was promoted to the development team and moved upstairs, which is where the developers were working. It's like one of those things, I didn't follow any of the good advice, right? You know, I didn't walk in, I didn't have a hard line, I didn't push on him, I didn't, like, you know, insist on a raise, although I got one. I didn't do any of these, like, best practices things, but it just worked out for me. I just asked, that's it. Now, there's a lot of other things I could tell you about the past 10 years, but I won't bore you with them. But the main thing is, over and over and over again, for me, my advancement has not been about setting a goal, though I think that is a very good thing to do. It has been about just following my passion. It's like, I want to do this. How can I do it? Great. And it's, I don't know, I think that's an important, I think that's an important part of everyone's life, is to follow the things that you really care about. So very shortly after phase two of my career, when I entered into computing, I discovered open source. And part of that was through my job. They used a language called Perl and an operating system called Linux. And I had never used either before I started the job, but I learned them very quickly because that was the way to get promoted to being a developer. And the first year I took the Perl development class at the local Linux user group, and the second year I taught the Perl class at the local Linux user group. So getting involved in open source for me was about doing stuff that really makes a difference in the world. Like, I can make you a website that sells pet toys. Sure, I can do that, but I don't really care about that. Whereas open source was, you know, especially at that time, it was really just getting started, and it was fundamentally changing the nature of how innovation happens. It was fundamentally changing the game for technology. You know, it's like, let's make technology available to school children in Africa. And I'm not talking about the Gates Foundation donating a certain number of licenses to a certain school, which is great. It's about radically shifting technology. And now, you know, anyone can install an operating system completely for free, completely legal. And it has, you know, it's like, yeah, it changes the world. And that was really exciting for me. Another part of it is, again, back to that whole social nature of computing. Open source, much more strongly than you know, your average sort of technology job, is very, very much about the communities around software. It's very, very much about your connections with people. And, you know, I went from knowing a handful of programmers at my work to knowing hundreds, even thousands of programmers all around the world. And that got me back into my other passion, which is travel. Because now that I was working with people all around the world, I had a whole lot more reason to go and visit different places, speak at different conferences. It's not rattling around in the back of a beaten up old Land Rover on bad roads. It's flying in airplanes, which my back is totally fine with. but it sort of, it ended up supplying a very important piece of my life that kept me involved and kept me going. Those social connections. All right, so enough about me. So there'll be a lot of talks this week about sort of practical steps that you can take to advance your career and get involved and do more and be more. And I think there's a very, very fundamental piece underneath all of it, and that is, what drives you to get involved? What drives you to stay involved? Western culture tries to motivate people with money. That is like a very fundamental aspect of the whole definition of your career, is that you should be motivated by money. And you might be. If you are, it'll be really easy for you because that's the way they'll try to motivate you. I know a lot of women who aren't. I know a lot of men who aren't. I'm not. Now, that said, I have increased my income by a factor of 10 over the past decade. But it wasn't because I set out to do that, and it wasn't because I even really care about it. There are some things that are important to me. I now expect I will be able to pay for my son's college education instead of having to make him go into debt like I did. I can donate to organizations like Doctors Without Borders, you know, with no stress, and I'm happy to do that. I can pay for my mother's health insurance, and that's really important to me. But money in itself does not motivate me. Like, I don't go into work every day and think, yay, I'm getting paid. It just doesn't. If you're in the same boat, then you may find that you have to find alternate motivations. You may have to find your own personal motivations for getting up in the morning and going into work. Some people are motivated by status, by their karma, by getting points on Slashdot, by whatever. I'm not. A lot of women aren't. A lot of men aren't, honestly. So again, our culture does try to motivate you through this avenue, and if it doesn't motivate you, then you're going to have to find another motivation. I'm not at all motivated by having power over other people. That's, to me, not even slightly interesting. I've ended up in a lot of leadership positions, but it's not because I wanted them. And in some ways, I think that the leaders who desire to be powerful are the worst leaders you could possibly have. That's, you don't want someone in power who is like just gleefully like exercising their power over you. No one does. So here's my motivation. My motivation is people. I get into leadership positions because they allow me to help other people. They give me a way of making other people succeed, of empowering other people to succeed. They give me a way of solving problems and getting blockers out of the way for other people. When I'm in a company and I think about making that company successful, I don't really care about the profit margins of the company. But the idea of you know, understanding someone's dream, you know, the dream of the people who really created the company, and helping to make that dream a reality, and that really motivates me. That gets me interested. That keeps me going. And, you know, just day to day, like helping the people around me and helping kids in Africa get access to technology, or my current role is more about medicine and helping to make medicines available to people in third world countries at a cost they can actually afford. Those are the kinds of things that actually motivate me. And that feeds into technology directly over and over and over again. You just have to, you know, don't allow the world to divorce you from reality. Don't allow it to tell you you should be like motivated by things you don't care about. And don't be discouraged if you aren't motivated by the things that they tell you you should be. I'm motivated by changing the world. I think a lot of people are, when you really get down to it, even the ones who say they're motivated by money, it's or power or recognition. It's not really about that. It's about having an impact. You know, when we leave, life is short. When we leave this world, we want to look back and see that we had an impact. We made a difference. And I'm also motivated by seeing things done. Like, I don't know why. I've run into people over the years, and they're like, yeah, we're just working. I like to see things done. And that kind of drives me to, like when I'm in a computing project, to push ahead very fast. Because I want to get to that point where I'm like, aha, look at this. It's all finished. It all fits together. The code all fits together. So the motivation that you find, whatever it is, and it may not be the same as mine, it may not be the same as anyone around you, but the motivation that you find, that's what's going to help you get through when you run into obstacles, when you run into difficulties or discouragement. That motivation is what you fall back on. You say, look, I'm doing this because of I'm changing the world. I'm doing this because I'm helping people. And that's like an... That's your like almost like a safety net in some ways that you can fall back on over and over and over again. This really matters. What I'm doing really matters. I have to check the time. Okay. So I call the topic the talk Computational Zen. And this is something that I've studied Buddhism in the last few years just out of interest. And one of the things that it talks about a lot is the path, sort of like the path to enlightenment. And I think in computing, we also each have our path. And it's not just about the destination, but the way we walk along our path has a deep, deep impact on our life. So you can't do everything. You can't. There's no way. There are a million things you will want to do in your life. So along the way, you're going to have to choose which things you're going to do. We all desire to be understood. We all desire to have people around us who have been where we've been, done what we've done. And I think one of the hardest things for women in computing is that we often don't have that understanding, or at least not in the places where we expect to find it. I know that some women have struggled with not having understanding from their families or not having understanding from their friends or even going into computing groups and expecting to find understanding there and not finding it there either. And I think part of the value of events like this is we can step away from the everyday and find people who really do understand us. But the flip side of it is sometimes you have to kind of set your own path, even though you don't find the understanding you want. I have been called fearless. I am not fearless. My mother likes to tell these hugely embarrassing stories about my childhood when I was, you know, like 3 feet tall, and I'm a very, very shy person. Incredibly shy. And when I was like 3 years old, every time someone walked up to my mother, I would start screaming and crying because I just couldn't handle people. In fourth grade, I had to give a talk every single week, and I cried through every single talk that I gave for half a year. Like every single talk that I gave, I cried all the way through it. Fear is something that I've struggled with my whole life, and the fact that people call me fearless now, I think is largely just because I had to work so much harder to overcome fear that now it's like, I don't know, I developed a coping mechanism. I figured out how to put it down. Sometimes I'm even a little too fearless and I wander into things because I'm like, oh, no, that's just fear. I'll ignore it. I'll like plow straight in. And then afterwards I realize, well, maybe that fear was actually a reasonable fear. But I think fear is something that you can overcome. So if you're avoiding doing something that you want to do because you're afraid, don't let the fear get in your way. Just don't. Do whatever you have to do to overcome that fear. And not all fear is bad. Aside from, you know, keeping you from, I don't know, jumping out of an airplane without a parachute, fear is actually a wonderful motivator for being really well prepared. Fear of giving a talk can drive you to give the best talk you have ever given in your entire life. Fear of taking a new job can drive you to study in intense detail every piece of technology that they use, and when you walk in the door, you're like an expert. Sometimes fear can also cause overcompensation. And I have seen some women and some men walk into a situation and they're like incredibly aggressive. And there are some people who can pull off being incredibly aggressive, and that's fine. But if you're not naturally an aggressive person and you feel like you have to put on aggressiveness to enter a situation, a lot of times you're just not very good at being aggressive, and so it comes off entirely wrong. So just be aware that sometimes when you're fearful, you will come out of your box a lot more powerful than you really need to be, and you might have to kind of like tone yourself back down again, sort of balance out. This is something I thought a lot about in 2005, but since then as well. It is okay to be angry when you've been mistreated. That's a good thing. It's a grieving process, and you should be angry. And you should tell people about the fact that you're angry, and you have every right to be angry. But be aware of the fact that in intense anger, it is very, very difficult to build anything good. So if you are coming from a position of anger, a position of anger is very easy for destroying things. So it's very easy to attack the old way of doing things. It's very easy to tear down the system. It's not very easy to build a new system. And sometimes you have to moderate your anger. Sometimes you have to set aside your anger so that you can build something new. And I think part of what Women in Computing is about tearing down old ways of doing things. But part of it is also building a wholesome, gender-neutral, culture-neutral ecosystem. And I think if we only embrace the anger, we're never going to build that. I have seen sometimes men be trashed in public for, I'll call it ignorance. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't realize that it was hurtful. And partly it's the anger thing again, striking out of anger against someone who, you know, did something wrong. I think it's important to always keep in mind that there's a difference between prejudice and ignorance. If someone is prejudiced, then they believe that you can't do it. They believe that you are wrong. If someone is ignorant, they may in fact want to encourage you to do more. They may in fact want you to succeed, and they just didn't know any better. So try to be, sensitive to that difference, because it's a different way of approaching them. A guy who really wants you to succeed and just said something dumb, he doesn't need to be torn to pieces and thrown on the floor. He needs to be gently reminded, it would really be better for me if you would do such and such. And what I've found over and over again is if he really is in that ignorance and not prejudice, he will say, oh, thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I didn't realize that I was doing that. I'm doing a little bit of a scattershot of philosophy here. It's sometimes hard to accept, but as women in computing, or men in computing, or anyone in computing, or anyone in anything, we are not entitled to success. And that's a hard truth, but as much as you want to succeed, as much as we want you to succeed, you might not, and it might not be anyone's fault. It's just the nature of the game. Not every actor in Hollywood gets work. A lot of them work in a grocery store. And some of the anger comes from a feeling of entitlement. Like, I am here, I am working hard, I should succeed. And I think that sort of like the compensation or the balance for that, for the entitlement, is a feeling of gratitude. And I don't mean a groveling sort of gratitude, like, oh, thank you for giving me this opportunity. But I mean just like waking up every day and thinking, isn't it amazing that I live in a society, that I live in a time that allows me to work on computing, that allows me to touch the lives of so many people through this technology, and where there are very few things that are denied me. I know we're not there yet, and we have a long way to go in terms of equality, but I think there's a happiness in recognizing how far we've come, and also a confidence that we can get the rest of the way because of how far we've come so far. I won't talk about relationships much. Because I think everyone has their own personal path. I personally have a rule of never getting involved with anyone that I work with on a project or company. But I will say one thing, and that is, if you have tried to learn about technology from a significant other, or tried to teach technology to a significant other, whether that's your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever, and it didn't work, don't feel bad about that. There is a level of emotional vulnerability that you have with a significant, like with someone that you are that close to, that is really not helpful in a learning or teaching scenario. And a lot of it, I think, is just taking mental leaps requires a degree of peace, a degree of zen. And when you bring emotional complications into that, it's very hard to achieve that peace, that state of mind that allows you to take great leaps forward. So it's mainly just a matter of, don't feel bad if that doesn't work. Go. If you want your boyfriend to learn about computers, go and find somebody else to teach him, or whatever. You know, it's like just be very accepting that not all relationships are good for technical advancement. It's kind of a little bit of a repetition of something that I said before, but we all have sort of like desires of where we want to go, but we can't exert control over every situation, and in some ways, you kind of have to be open to whatever comes along. And that is both the bad things and the good things. But when you're in the midst of the chaos and you find that what you expected or what you hoped isn't going to happen, something that has served me very well over and over again is kind of keeping an eye out for where the greatest potential is. There are only two times when I have quit a job without having another job to go to afterwards. And both of those times, not immediately, but very quickly thereafter, resulted in one of the greatest leaps forward in my career. So sometimes it's a little bit about taking a risk. Not being afraid to do things that you've never done before, not being afraid to do things that really don't make any sense whatsoever to most of the people around you. I don't really recommend quitting your job without having a replacement job, just as a general rule, but it worked out very well for me. When you're thinking about... A lot of times I see people giving advice about how you should act as a woman in computing, how you should relate to your peers, how you should relate to your managers, and I think there's a lot that you can learn from that, and you should listen to that, but at the same time, you may find that that is not your true self. You may find that that particular way of relating to people, even if it is supposedly a guaranteed path to success, it just doesn't fit who you are. And that's okay. Don't worry about it. Like, adapt things. You know, over time, pick up tips here and there and adapt who you are and adapt what you do and adapt your interests. But ultimately, if you're going to succeed, you don't want to succeed as somebody else. You don't want to succeed as someone who isn't you. Because you will be forever pushed into that box. And that's not a happy place to be. I strongly, strongly encourage people to keep learning all the time because my son is 14 now, and he tells me, only a few more years and then freedom. I don't have to learn anymore. Which is terrible. I think it's terrible that our schools encourage that perspective. So, like, whatever you're doing, wherever you go, wherever you're working, whatever your job is, learn about what other people are doing, or take a class outside, even if it doesn't seem like it's relevant to your current job, because you never know. If it's something that interests you, it might end up leading to your job 5 years from now. Maybe a better job. And always, 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 oh goodness, don't stop. Don't be satisfied with where you are. Don't think, you know, I am what I am today and this is all that I can be. That's just not true. Whatever you are today, you're going to be completely different 10 or 20 years from now. You are. And you can decide how you're going to be completely different. I mean, I guarantee you'll be completely different. That's not even a question. But you can actually direct how you change and how you grow. And do things. Don't just sit back. Don't just take what comes to you. Don't just say, okay, this is my job. This is what I have to do every day. A lot of the opportunities that have come my way have come because I was doing something completely unrelated. So open source software never paid me. I just did it on the side because it was interesting. And yet, giving talks, going out and meeting with people, over the decade and a half, it gave me visibility. It gave me skills that I didn't have before. It gave me connections that I didn't have before. And that work that I did for free, on the side, for fun, was actually the driver of my career, of my entire career. That's what put me where I am. So I've talked over a lot of things, so a lot of sort of scattered ideas. But if you only take one thing away, just one thing from this talk, I want you to go away knowing that you can do it. That you, right now, you, not the you that you think you should be, or the you that you think the person next to you is, or the you that you think the guy down the hall is, but you, right now, can have a significant impact on the world of computing. So go do it. Just change the world. Namaste.
So does anybody have any questions before she runs away? Come up to the mic, you can make it shorter.
Go ahead.
Oh, Nicole does. Go, Nicole.
Go ahead, you can go up there and wait. Go ahead.
So I really appreciated the part where you said you can find what motivates you to do what you do. It might be money, it might be power, it might be reputation. And it's okay if what motivates you isn't what motivates other people. How have you been able to use that to interact differently with other people? Because I realize that I've finally gotten to the point where I can just decide to tell everyone to screw it because I know what I like. And I'm trying to work on understanding that better in other people because this is what works for me. So have you been able to use that in your other work relationships as well, or any advice?
Yeah, I have. I think one of the reasons, one of the impacts that it has had is because I don't care about money, I have had that kind of screw you attitude about jobs, in the sense that I take the job that interests me most instead of the job that pays me the best. And that has actually sort of, in a reverse way, led me to better and better jobs over time because I wasn't tied into their motivational scheme. But I think it's also had a very big impact on the way I manage people, in the sense that because I'm more motivated by helping them than I am by any kind of status thing, that makes me a really good manager. because I'm, you know, I've had some really bad managers, not many, but a few, and one of the things I noticed about them is that they were totally self-centered. And that makes for a really bad manager. The best managers I've ever had are the ones that are like focused on the people who are working for them and how to make those people the best they can possibly be. It's like tending a garden or something, you know, like you really see each person as and their potential, and you're helping them grow towards that potential.
Hi, Allison. I was struck by something you said pretty early in your talk, that you treat all men like brothers, in particular younger brothers. As someone who doesn't have any brothers and is not likely to get them at this point, could you maybe elaborate a little bit on that? Because like you, I work pretty much exclusively with men. My group is all men, and I'm always looking for tips on how to relate to them maybe differently from the way that I do, how to look at them differently. Anything you can share on that? Thank you.
It's a little bit hard to articulate because I do it almost subconsciously, but strongly platonic is part of it, and that helps eliminate a lot of the stress. Another part of it is I'm not embarrassed about the fact that I am kind of a nurturing personality, and I take care of people. And, you know, that doesn't have to be, like, strongly feminine. It's just, like, I am very interested in helping other people succeed and grow and change, and people respond to that. It's like they have a sense that you've got their back, that you're there for them, and you're interested in their success, too. I think that's part of it. And I think the older sister part is, I kind of, so it's actually caught me out a few times. I kind of have an assumption that, oh, it's like a working hypothesis, and it's not conscious, that I know a little bit more than everybody else in the room, but it's not the kind of really jerky guy thing where it's like, I know more than you, and you must, like, it's much more of a, just sort of a relaxed confidence about it. And I've actually been surprised sometimes, like, I was working with someone remotely, and I had taken that sort of big sister attitude towards them, but I'd never met them, and somehow mentally in my head, the guy was like 20 years old and a little bit green and a little bit inexperienced, and that was kind of the way he acted on IRC. And I met him, and he was like 50 and had a PhD in computer science, and it's like, I don't know, it just sort of like my model of the universe put him in a role, and he dropped right into that role, even though, in fact, like, in theory, in sort of like traditional terms, the relationship should have been entirely different. I don't know if that's helpful, but.
Thank you for the talk, first of all. It was really helpful. And my question is, at work, sometimes when we are treated like disrespectfully, like because of prejudice or some ignorance, sometimes it is really hard to distinguish if it comes from prejudice or ignorance. So I'm wondering if you can give some advice to us to handle that kind of situation if we are in that kind of situation.
This is one of those things, it's one of those hard questions because there's not an easy, perfect answer. My own personal preference is to assume ignorance until it's proven to be prejudice. Sort of give people the benefit of the doubt and start gently and not start with anger. Anger may be merited later, and harsh action may be merited later, but at least start with just sort of a gentle response of, you know, I'm sure you didn't know what you were doing, but here's something. Sometimes it may mean moving to a different place. Like, that's not the first answer, but I have found there are huge differences between companies, like cultures in companies, and if you find you're not comfortable where you're working for any reason, and it may not even be prejudice or ignorance, it may be completely unrelated, don't quit. right away, but keep an eye out for opportunities elsewhere. Keep an eye out for cultures that do respect you more. And be ready to jump if something comes along. There are a lot of things you can do, and there'll be some talks later today about how you can help, even from inside a company, if the culture as a whole is not conducive to women, if it's not wholesome and encouraging. And minorities too, honestly. It really does affect both. There are things you can do to help gradually shift the culture over time. And sometimes there are things you can do that, you know, you may have not thought of it because you didn't realize it was a problem. So Sheryl Sandberg wrote a book, and she talks about how she was at Google, and she was, like, enormously pregnant, and she was, like, waddling miles from the parking lot to get into meetings first thing in the morning. And her husband said, you know, at Yahoo, we have parking for pregnant women. Why don't you just ask? And she was like, she walked into Larry Page's office and said, I need parking for pregnant women. And he's like, yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And they still have it to this day. They still have special dedicated parking for pregnant women. So sometimes it is just about being a little bit courageous to step out and ask for things. Hope that's helpful.
Hi. So earlier, based off a question that a woman had earlier about what your motivations are and everything. So question about your motivations, like you said, yours is you're driven by people, you don't have to be paid the most or anything. It's just your enjoyment and your fulfillment. But how do you balance that in work? Where other people may know what your motivations are, and you might not get treated the best, like, you know, I enjoy doing this work, but you get, like, the longest hours, and you like it, but it's just like, okay, you're wearing me out, but, you know, I enjoy this work. Like, how do you balance people not taking advantage of what your motivations are?
Well, I have to say, I have never said to my job, I never have never walked in and said to an employer, I don't care what you pay me, I'm just here for the fun of it. so, you know, I haven't said to people, you know, I'm really only in this job because I want to make a difference in the world, because I care about making people better, or care about helping people. I do think, yeah, sometimes you'll find if you don't care about money and you're not, like, aggressively chasing after the highest salary, you may sometimes find that someone may take that as a sign that, oh, you're not really a team player, you're not really the right stuff, kind of thing. I think if you're working with someone who evaluates you on that criteria, I would have a hard time staying at a company like that very long. I would tend to move on pretty quickly. But if you have to just not talk about what your motivations are, that's okay. And, you know, like I said, despite the fact that I really don't care at all about money, I'm fine. I'm doing fine. Like, like, raises came anyway. I've never asked for a raise, but they came anyway. And they came anyway as a result of working really hard and you know, just what I was doing. But the raises were always a result of what I was doing and not a result of me caring about money. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. And I don't think you can rely on that, like, in life. I don't think that happens to everyone.
No. So I have a question, and I'm mic'd. Awesome. Okay. My question is, a lot of people, a lot of women, don't have it as easy as your story is. So what would you say to women who believe that they feel they have to work harder than the men in their office in order to have the same level of success or achievement or the same level of recognition? Since you're mentoring, you probably hate to deal with this.
I do. So there's kind of two answers. And one of the answers is that has to change. Like, over time, we just can't have that continue to be the truth, that women have to work harder than men to achieve the same level of success. But I know that it is true for some women now, for a lot of women now. And so if you want to achieve the same level of success as men, do the harder work. And know that not only are you benefiting yourself, but the more success you achieve, the better example you will be for all the other women who follow you. So it's worth the extra work to change perceptions and over time shift the balance. And if you don't want to put in that extra work, also don't feel bad about it. Don't feel bad about saying, you know what, these are my priorities, this is where I want to focus my effort, and I will put in the same level of effort as the guy sitting next to me. And if I don't get the same level of success, that is too bad, but this is what I'm willing to do. This is where I'm willing to go, and this is how far I'm willing to push. And don't feel like you're... I know women who get like this pedestal feeling, this like, I'm setting an example for every woman that follows, and I just have to feel horribly guilty if I don't work 80 hours a week and you know, like, push for every raise and go, 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 go. Don't feel like that. Honestly, any success you achieve, any like promotions you get, any progress you make, any impact you have on the world as a woman in computing changes the world just a little bit. Because over time, it's like raindrops washing down a mountain, you know? Like, any little thing you do will help shift the balance. And don't feel like you have to be, like, this fighter all the time. I've known some women who, like, didn't go into computing at all because they're like, oh, it's just too much of a fight. I'm going to be fighting all the time. Don't feel like you have to be that person who stands in the gap and is the freedom fighter. Even if you do a little bit, it makes a difference.
Any other questions? No? Thank you.
Thank you.